Hello and welcome to Willosophy. I'm Will Anderson. This is my podcast where I ask intelligent people stupid questions to find out the meaning of life or something. Basically, I ask people if they have a philosophy, if they've ever thought about what their philosophy is and how it applies to various aspects of their life. But it's just a general conversation about life. It's not an interview. It's a conversation with people that I know and that I like and that I'm engaged with. And sometimes I'll talk and sometimes they'll talk and sometimes I'll interrupt them. These are all things that I know I do. So feel free not to give me feedback about that. It's my podcast. Start your own podcast if you want to do it your way. This is my way. Anyway, let's not start aggressively. Thanks for listening. This is a great podcast. This was the original second podcast I did with my old friend Adam Spencer. We used to do the Triple J Breakfast Show together for people who are not of that vintage or never heard that. We've been getting together a bit recently because Triple J is about to celebrate 40 years on air. So Spence and I are going to do a shift together on Double J. And so we've been recording some stuff for a documentary and a whole bunch of different things. So January 19, if you have digital radio, we will be on Double J. We won't be on live that day, unfortunately, because neither of us were available, but we are recording an entire show and we're going to catch up with some old friends. It'll be fun. It'll be really great fun. And it's been, it was great fun to catch up with him about a year ago for this old episode of Willosophy. If you're new to the podcast, basically I started it last year look, for a myriad of reasons I explained on other episodes, it stopped. So I'm posting all the old episodes and then hopefully in the new year, then we'll have brand new episodes. So if you didn't catch this one with Adam Spencer, or if you didn't, you're just listening again because you enjoyed it, make sure that you check out Adam's new book, Adam Spencer's Big Book of Numbers. I got it for Christmas from Adam. But it is a really fantastic book and really great gift, or just really great if you're fascinated in numbers and maths yourself. So Adam Spencer's Big Book of Numbers, check that out. And hope you enjoyed today's episode. January 19, the day I couldn't do the Triple J thing. I couldn't do it because, of course, I'm recording the last night of my Willuminati tour at the Sydney Opera House. Tickets are on sale for that if you want to come and see me in the concert hall of the Sydney Opera House doing Willuminati. That'd be absolutely fantastic. And my Free Will shows are on sale in Adelaide, Melbourne and Brisbane. And as I'm being poured a glass of champagne as I do this introduction, that's a very, very nice way to think that I live my life, doing my introductions out in the office being poured champagne on a beautiful summer's day. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode and I'll talk to you again soon. Cheers. Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Willosophy. I'm going to introduce my guest straight away this time because I thought in the first episode I took too long.
You did.
See, no, I wanted even to get in.
No.
This is my thing.
I've been sitting here for 14 point. This thing goes down to thousandths of a second.
Yeah. I thought you'd enjoy that. Adam Spencer is my guest and he's already distracted from this podcast by the mathematics of my recording machine.
You could qualify drivers in Formula One racing with this recording device.
Well, I need that,
thousands,
Adam, because of the precision of my questions on this podcast. It's what people have become used to in the one episode I've already put up.
Yeah, and I enjoyed all 1 hour, 7 minutes and 22 seconds of it.
Right. Well, I mean, I can even get it more specific than that if you need.
Could really have blown out.
Oh. When I re-release the director's edit, there is no director's edit. I just put it all up.
I have to know,
yes,
because I'm sure many people listening would have heard Todd's quite amazing stories. Did you already have me lined up to go as number two, or did you chat with Todd?
Yeah.
And at about the 8 minute mark of his Willosophy, when he's explained how one of his good mates from high school was murdered, and another guy he knew from high school was a murderer, and his sister, who was married to the Navy SEAL who killed for a living, he'd only just found out was his sister because he used to tape his own parents secretly with a device under the chair and listen back to it when they were out of the house.
What I like, well, firstly, before you get to your point, what I like is if people didn't hear the first episode, they just got a previously on McLeod's Daughters. You just caught them up.
That's
with
right.
Everything you missed from episode one. Everything you'll need to know to understand episode two.
Last week on Arrested Development, and was it about that stage you thought, I know who we need for our second one?
Yeah. I said, this reminds me a lot of Adam Spencer.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. I was doing the maths on how many kids, and I was like, maths, I'll get Spence on next. Yeah, it was pretty amazing, and I did not know a lot of those stories.
No.
My kind of attitude with it is I want to talk to people and just hopefully discover things that you can't Google about them and things that people might not be able to know. So, the first thing that I asked him and the first thing I'm going to ask you is, do you have a philosophy? Is there something – like, you know, he talked a lot about, you know – stuff that I've forgotten. There was doors.
The door to life.
Yeah.
The door to life can be opened, but you have to open it yourself.
Yes.
You can't just stand there willing it to open.
Yes. Yes. Unless it's hospital doors. Mm. They open by themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, there is some exceptions to the rule.
We did a talk back recently on my highly successful breakfast radio show in Sydney, and we were talking about, because we'd taken our kids to the Gold Coast for a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing some work up there. So Mel has gone and got the girls from school. Complete surprise. I didn't even know that. She said, we're going somewhere to have some lunch.
Okay.
Put them in the cab and they're going out to lunch, and then the girls finally realize, well, we're going to the airport for lunch.
Wow.
This is the worst part.
Terrible decision. Oh, everything's expensive.
Yeah.
The line's really long. Those sandwiches have been there all day.
Actually, you're going on a plane.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Good. And I speak to them. I'm on the Gold Coast. They're in Sydney at the airport. I speak to them, and they're so excited they can barely speak. And one of them's going, are we going to Disneyland? So eventually go to the Gold Coast. They stay in the hotel where I'm doing this show. It's a pretty good hotel. There's a massive kids' playground. We go to SeaWorld the next day. They come back after that. It's all a complete surprise. I just thought they were going to school. The only thing they can talk to their friends about when they get back was, it was unbelievable. In the hotel room, there was this phone. You pick up the phone and you'd say, could I please have some chips? And this guy would bring you chips.
Right.
That was all. No fucking SeaWorld.
Right.
No fucking let's fly up to the Gold Coast instead of doing school for the afternoon. We mentioned that on the show and had to talk about when you were a kid, just the prism you'd see things through. On your holidays.
Wouldn't it just be great if you could still, to be honest, people who follow my career know there's nothing I enjoy more than being in a hotel room after a gig and ordering chips. But
if it really works out for you, you will have 24/7 room service anytime you are anywhere in the world. We had people calling in and saying, you know, that one guy, the elevators, the only time he ever got in an elevator was when they went on holidays.
Uh-huh.
Another guy came to Sydney around the time that your automatic opening doors, you were saying like your hospital doors, were first installed in the city. They didn't have him in the country town he was from. Him and his brother spent an hour in the city just walking in and then out of this one building, just like they were going through a portal into another dimension and just unable to believe.
And there's two security guys just looking at, like, through the security footage going, they're from the country. Yeah. It's okay.
Either this is the most elaborate decoy ever, and right, there's another guy at the back with some serious guns and a truck just emptying this place, or they're from the country. And my favourite one was a guy who couldn't believe how when they were on holiday, they were staying at some motor inn and you could write on a piece of paper the night before, can I have some eggs and toast? And you put that in a box at the door, and overnight that piece of paper turned into eggs.
Oh.
How, you know, like the Christian transubstantiation miracle of Christ, the bread actually becomes the body of Christ.
My God.
This piece of paper turned into eggs.
I would steal that box. I'd be going home writing things on pieces of paper.
It's an amazing box. You could turn it into jam.
Yeah.
And toast, anything like that. But my philosophy, I had one in mind, and then today I was at a place where I had to go and buy some stuff and quickly raced into the bathroom, and there was a sign there that said, please do not put paper towels in the urinal.
Mm.
And I think that's now.
That's it? That's
now
your new one?
Yeah, because what I had was all right, but it wasn't, wasn't as compelling as that.
I mean, at least they said please.
Yeah.
Like, you go back in a few more weeks, like, we fucking told you. Stop putting them in.
Yeah.
We asked nicely last time.
It suggests there's a class of people out there for whom they put paper towels in urinals. You can either be polite to them, or you can just go the brute force of, it is forbidden to put paper towels in this. And obviously, whatever personality type it is appropriate, people have put paper towels in this particular urinal at the Sydney Chess Academy in Burwood in Sydney. Those people are more the, hey, let's, you know, let's establish a link and make you realize that I'm a person too, and we're all on this planet together.
Well, it's a chess thing, isn't it? They're seeing forward to what the next step might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they actually have that forethought of going, don't be angry at them first time. Because they will then respond with aggression, and that's not what we want in this situation. Suddenly they're going to be putting paper towels everywhere. Yeah. They're going to be pissing on the walls.
Exactly. I'm just putting my bishop here, mate. You can have a move now. But my philosophy, I think...
Well, no, let's just linger on this before we actually get to your philosophy. Because from that point of view, where you're talking about the two ways that you can sort of tell somebody something.
Yes.
You know, you can sort of demand it of them or that you can ask it of them.
Mm.
You're a father of children. Is there one of those two approaches that you think works the best?
It'd probably go one each way with our two kids.
Right. But is that a thing in itself that, like, you know, when you have kids, like, you made those kids with the same person, like in the same place?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the same ingredients.
She's just here
in the background.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she would know.
You know, and we made...
Right, that's what she told him.
That's
the first heckle we've ever had on the podcast. That's the equivalent of Todd's bombshell.
Yeah, and that's...
this is when you find out you're not the father of your children. Two episodes in, two bombshells. Great podcast, people. Download it.
The great one they have when they say to a guy, how many kids have you got? You say, two that I know of.
Right.
You never hear a woman saying, two that I know of. You
have to be particularly sleepy.
There's...
Very sleepy woman.
A lot more clarity. And when we did make two children, and we made one at least, I wasn't specifically going to say the brown three-seater couch. I was going to say in this room.
Right.
Yeah.
This space is like a space where life was created.
Sacred site.
So, a sacred site? Have you lobbied the local council?
Not that old. I'm a chance to go around again.
I mean, it hasn't been used a lot recently.
Nah. Sure.
It's fallen into a state of disrepair.
Sure.
But we feel if we could get a Kickstarter together.
Yeah. We need someone like Leo Schofield to just take ownership of it and pay for the upkeep.
Yeah.
So I think it probably depends on kid by kid as to which responds better to a bit of force or a bit of humanity. And also... You know, some kids, different times, each of them. But certainly with our two kids, one of them is a little bit more when she does something wrong, is more likely to feel bad that she's done that and feel that she's let herself down and you guys down. And the other one is far more if she does something wrong and you say, that's it, you know, consequences, rather than any denial or anything, she'll literally say, how long? As in, how many minutes am I on the stairs?
Right.
And with her, it's never a matter of what I do or no, I didn't, or I'm sorry. It's, you know, those episodes.
She's just one of those people who's like, I just do my time.
You know, the law.
I'm just going to go in. I'm going to do my time.
It's more the part. It's not at the conviction. It's that bit of the episode of Law and Order when they go into the room and McCoy is there and they all go, well, what's on the table? And you say, you're going to go 15 minutes up the stairs. And you kid, 15?
15?
I'm not doing 15 on the stairs for that. You know, I'll do 10.
Yeah.
8 for good behavior. Right. Any more than 10, you know.
Otherwise, I want to test this in front of a jury of my peers.
Exactly. Are you putting man 2 on the table? Because if you're not, we're out of here. I'll take my life.
Explain to me what your theories on. I don't mean that specifically, you know, but the fact that the two girls are different.
Yep.
Like, where do you fall then when it comes to things like nature versus nurture and you know, and what difference those things make?
Yeah. And they are. And they're even very. Like a really fundamental, my wife Mel is a quarter Greek. So her mum's dad was a Greek guy.
Okay.
And the vast bulk of the rest of her ethnic is just Anglo and Australian, Anglo-Saxon and Australian stuff. But he's a quarter, so he's Greek. So our girls are 1/8 Greek.
No.
And
one loves Con the Fruiterer. The other does not.
Ellie, the elder girl. None of it.
Right.
Blue eyes, blonde hair. Olivia, the younger one. Ellie's blue eyes, my mum's eyes. Like exactly the same. Ellie still looks a lot like her mum, but the eyes and all that, no. Olivia, brown eyes, curlier hair. And when they both run around at the beach over summer, Ellie is a white kid who gets a tan. And Olivia just goes this deep brown olive. You could honestly, after they've been in the son for the same amount of time for a month, you could say to someone, oh, no, they're cousins, and her dad is Maltese.
So let's talk about your actual philosophy, what you were going to say then. We'll take on board that you've given us a bonus philosophy.
Sure.
You've given us the don't stuff the toilet towels
in the
urinal. Don't do that. Because they expand. That's the thing that people don't know, paper towels. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can reuse paper towels. I've seen the advertisements. You're meant to wash them out. But if you shove them in the urinal, that's not helping anybody.
Yes, they don't show you that on the ad.
And do they do that at the chess club, which is weird to me because I would have thought that if people were really into chess, they'd be like those people who never left the table. You know what I mean? Like, shouldn't it be like people in casinos where they like a wing under the table and stuff because they're just so into the idea of chess, or is it not that sort of thing?
I think in most of your standard tournament play, either the game is so short that you should be able to hold it for, say, 15 minutes timed each game, or the game is long enough that you can walk away from the table and come back. So the World Chess Championships are taking place at the moment.
Yep. I saw. There's a young rapscallion upcomer. Right.
Vishy Anand, the 43-year-old Indian world champion, who's been the world champion for a lot of the last 10 or so years, and Magnus Carlsen, might be 22 now, young Norwegian, who's, crazy young punk, and he was a grandmaster at the age of 15 and was a model for G-Star Raw clothing.
Really?
Yeah. The chess guys like explaining he was a fashion model at the age of 18. Now, no disrespect to him.
He chose the right career?
He didn't get it entirely on looks. He's not unattractive, and in a room of randomly selected chess grandmasters, you'd probably go, he's cute.
But it's rare that, like, you know, being good at chess gets you over the line in a modelling gig.
Rare double.
I've never seen an episode of Australia's Next Top Model where they've gone, how are you on a chessboard?
No, in the Beauty and the Geek, Beauty and the Geek would be your sort of petri dish for testing that stuff out. But, yeah, you're more likely. See you soon, sweetheart.
Bye,
my love. And, yeah.
No more secrets.
No more secrets and no more kids either, because I had a vasectomy. There you go. Bombshell. Bombshell. For anyone who wasn't listening to my radio show, because I did talk about it at the time. But to the other 85.4% of people in Sydney who don't listen to my show, fuck them. So World Chess Championship's taking place at the moment.
Yes.
Anand, 43, versus Carlsen, 23. And so the old-timers want the old cagey fox just to hold on one more time. Other seed is the changing of the chess guard. This younger guy, amazing, has a higher ranking than Anand and just plays phenomenal chess and will certainly be one of the greatest players of all time. That's taking place at this very moment. But in those matches, so they've got to have, I think it's 40 moves each in the first 2 hours, then your clock's reset and you get more time. They'll often just walk off and, if needed, if nature calls, you can go.
Right.
And come back. And while they're gone, they're just chewing the positions over anyway. Those guys don't.
I guess it's not like the other dude can swap all the pieces around. I was confusing it with like playing with your brother.
No. And it's also frowned on at that level to bump the board. We actually, when some guys at university who I debated with, a guy a couple of years older than me, was Tim Riley, very good chess player. And he was offered a big uni debating tournament once, only a couple of weeks before the National Chess Championships or something like that. And he had, in his room, about five different chess boards. I wasn't there, but the guys in the teams of that year's told me about five different chess boards set up in various positions for what he was exploring as different opening lines he wanted to pursue at this upcoming tournament. And so these wags would go in occasionally and move the pieces around while he was out at breakfast or something like that. He'd walk back into his room, look at the boards, and just instantly go, Warren, it's not funny. Then just go and rearrange the pieces back into the positions they were in on the five different chess boards in his room that these guys thought they were just, mucking him around big time by rearranging.
That's a great story, but it's also a great story because when you said wags, I imagine they were the wives and girlfriends of celebrity sports people. So,
those chess wags. did you see those at the Melbourne Cup last week? Some of those chess wags just behaving in the
all over
cage.
The social pages.
Just embarrassing.
Okay, so let's
can't take them anywhere.
Let's get to it. What were you going to have as your philosophy?
Yeah, and I was on that topic. It's a very interesting process to go through talking about thinking about being on something like this. Because you have to, spout forth your philosophy. And I don't know if I'd ever had one at the top of my mind that if people had just stopped me in the street and said, what is it?
Well, that's interesting to me in itself, mm-hmm. because I'm not sure that I necessarily would have one either. And that's part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation with people. And I certainly don't want it to be a sort of podcast where someone has to come on and say, this is it.
Yeah.
And I live by this.
Yeah.
And then I'm just going to use it to go through and look at all your stuff and go, hang on. That's the opposite of that.
Exactly. Why on this date did you? I saw you willing a door, Todd Sampson.
So I'm even interested in the idea that you perhaps wouldn't think immediately that you do have a philosophy.
Mm.
It's not something that comes into your mind every day.
No, and I see certain, I look at the things I do in life and can look back at those and go, oh, okay, I'm clearly a certain type of personality
mm-hmm.
or driven by certain types of things, but I rarely have a theme or belief that's driving them, and certainly not something that I would encapsulate my thoughts in a small number of words. And I'm not particularly the sort of person, in the scheme of people, not particularly the sort of person who thinks about life that much in that sense. In a group of people sitting around a table talking about the way the world is or why people, I would never, and it might be partly because I'm at the ABC, so I'm not meant to, but I would never talk about politics at a dinner party. Or it's just not the sort of thing.
What do you talk about at a dinner party? If someone, is doing one of those, there's five people that I want to have dinner with, and they nominate Adam Spencer, what are they going to get?
Yeah, they probably someone who just sits there in a sort of awkwardly, not quite shy, but doesn't really say that much and doesn't say as much as people would be expecting them to unless he's poked with a stick and asked to talk on topics.
What if we offered these people, if they paid $5,000 extra, they could poke you with a stick?
Yeah, well, then I'm on.
Are you willing to?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know that you're looking at new career options next year.
I'll take that. Yeah.
Dinner with Adam Spencer, $5,000 extra, poking with a stick. Shy seems like a word that people would not associate with you. So explain what that means, where that comes from. Is that one of those things where you are very social for work? You're talking to people every morning. You're hosting functions. You're talking to large groups of people. I certainly know that the thing that people find most surprising about me is how private and how quiet I am outside my work.
I need to know someone reasonably well before I'll just faff on with them about the first thing to pop out of my head. And in groups of people who all know each other, if I'm out with a group of, my wife's friends who I, earlier on in our relationship, I didn't know them that well or anything like that, most people would not have looked at me afterwards and gone, oh, that'd be the guy who talks for a living or cracks jokes.
There's the life of the party.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't even see him do any maths. No. I don't reckon that is him.
No, exactly. And so in that sense, I'd, shy or just not bored isn't the word, but just I don't naturally engage with that sort of stuff.
What does excite you then? What is in your brain? Because obviously you have a big brain and it's one that's being used all the time. I can't imagine you're just a person at home with that Homer Simpson little bird with the water in your brain, do-do-do-do-do, That's not what your brain's like. So what are you thinking about? What's in your head?
I'm constantly setting myself – I'm very obsessive about projects and tasks. So I don't see – much point in doing anything not particularly well. And so I tend to get a little bit obsessive about doing things as well as I can, which people sometimes understandably confuse with a competitiveness of I want to do this in a way because I want to beat everyone else who's doing it.
Uh-huh.
That's not the case. But if I'm going to do something, I want to do it as well as I can or at least have an indication as to how well I could do it.
Right.
So one of the great frustrations in my life was my time at university, which was wonderful. And when
best 15 years of your life,
my answer was best 9.5 years of my life by a long way. But I didn't complete my maths PhD and was never going to. But as much as because of some bad choices I made in terms of picking subjects on my way through and because of then with other things going on and distractions and all that, never really knuckling down and having a crack at it. And so I would much rather have given that everything I had and then been told by someone, you don't have a maths PhD in you, mate. That's fine. Don't be embarrassed about that. I'd much rather know that than now just not even know I'm not that upset by the fact that I don't have one as much as I just genuinely don't know if I could have got one or not.
I think that is really fascinating. I think people would not – I think it goes to that idea of it's the things that you don't try that are the things that – haunt you. Now, I'm not saying that you didn't try to do that, but I understand what you mean. It's very much, I'm at a point in my life where I'm, going over to America. I'm working a lot there, and it's really, a lot of it's starting again, you know, at the bottom. But, and, you know, I've been lucky enough, even in the last few weeks, I've been offered a couple of, you know, reasonably big jobs here, things that, like, you know, you kind of go, am I making the right decision? You know, I'm giving up a lot of money.
Five years ago, you would have just grabbed.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing that it always comes back to is I know that I will regret not seeing if I was good enough to do it.
Mm.
Like, I don't have any expectation that, you know, I think I'm a little bit late in life for it really to, like, you know, I'm nearly 40 years old. That's not the time you want to be starting your career in a new country. Like, I understand that it's not ideal circumstance, and I understand that there's plenty of people in that country who are as good at what I do as I am, like, you know, and I have to get a lot better to be that good, but I fucking just can't live with the idea that I didn't try to see. So I think that's a really, like, it's a very generous insight for you to give us right now, because people don't like to talk about that.
Mm.
People don't like to talk about the time where you don't regret, like you said, you don't regret that you didn't get the PhD. You regret that you didn't put yourself in a situation to have a proper crack at it and see if you could.
Yeah, because and also people have a very misguided understanding of mathematics, and they think that, you know, what it means to be good at mathematics. And as I jokingly say that, you know, in a room of randomly selected people, I'm a maths genius.
Right.
In a room of maths PhDs, I'm as dumb as a box full of hammers.
Right.
I just don't have any idea what's going on through it having been out of the game for a long time.
With the rest of us, you're Goodwill Hunting on the whiteboard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And with maths geniuses, you're just cleaning up, mopping up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I am both sides of the coin that is Matt Damon. It's just a matter of which way you're looking. But that's also, you know, because mathematics intimidates most people so much that if you can tell them what 9 times 14 is, you're in the upper echelons.
But isn't the – and look, I was thinking about this just today. I was thinking on the way over here because, you know, I've got some tax things that I need to do. and I was really just doing that sort of thing of going, I wish at school they'd said to me, we're going to teach you enough about accounting that you can look after your own money and know what's going on in your life and won't freak out around tax time. You don't need to be an accountant. Yeah. We're just going to teach you enough that so you can survive in life. And it's the same with maths. I feel like there's lots of things I'd love to know about maths, but I feel like the way that it was, particularly with the high school that I went to, the way that maths was presented, it wasn't inviting to people like me.
Yeah, and the other thing I've always said they can do a lot more, and it's the same debate they're having in New South Wales at the moment, in the scandalous situation where you can complete your HSC and not do maths. I find that very, very difficult. But part of the problem is there's not courses presented that people would want to do. I would, in terms of what a lot of people do at uni, at high school, unless they were going to go on to do stuff in mathematics at university, like engineering and that sort of stuff where you really need some more solid stuff, I'd strip out a lot of that syllabus and have people doing stuff that works on just the logical mind and the rigor of the mind, and those logical problems. There's 7 houses in a row, blue, green, yellow, and there's 3 guys, 2 guys, blah, 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 blah. Who's living next door to the guy who owns the parrot? And that sort of stuff. That's got nothing to do with mathematics, but it's all just logic and, that can't be because those two things would contradict each other. If you give younger people that sort of... Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. Who's got the One Direction tickets? Yeah. One of the following 3 people. Is it the vegetarian? That sort of thing. But that sort of rigor is so much more important than whether 15 years on you can remember your cosine rule for working out, you know, as you know, the relationship between the opposite side of a triangle and the angle.
Yeah. It's like the relationship between men and women. Am I right?
There you go.
Come on, guys.
What is it?
What is it?
With come those on. What's triangles. The deal with?
Okay, so let's go back and do this one more time.
Yes.
You don't necessarily have a philosophy, but you went to the effort of actually thinking about what it might be if you did have one.
Mm. Well, yeah, and so I was going to try and encapsulate where a lot of us at with the phrase that we should all play more chess.
Right.
And
what do you mean by that?
Well, a few different aspects of a statement like that. First of all, chess in itself, yep, I just think it's a beautiful, noble, dignified game to play.
Black people against white people. That's what you mean, right? That's what I'm getting out of this, right?
The idea of... No, the interaction between religious figures in bishops and horses in knights is just...
Yeah, that's right.
A lot going on.
You're lobbying for...
Exactly.
Priests can't marry women, but they can marry horses,
right? The queen is stronger than the king, but it is the king that one has to be protected. No, the I don't want to think about that too much. No, the... It's a game. I went to Ukraine years ago with a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And she was a very good chess player, and we used to play a lot in Sydney. And we were over there in her hometown of Lviv, which is not in Kiev, which is the capital, but far over to the west, small town, about 1 million people, small by Ukrainian standards, in a local square, sort of like your Hyde Park or something in Sydney where people play chess, where all the old, a lot of them homeless and, you know, drinking guys, but being Ukrainians, they can play chess.
Right.
Just used to hustle tourists for money.
Chess hustlers.
Totally. Totally. Just playing. It's like one hryvnia to play.
Right.
And you play these guys, and they've all got enough of an understanding of chess that any standard opening you're going to play against me, they know it to 8 or 10 moves, and they know a couple of little tricks such that they will just weed you out.
Right.
They'll be far enough ahead, and off they go. I sit down playing against this guy, and I'm sitting next to my friend Veronica, and people don't speak English in this part of Lviv. Certainly older gentlemen who are...
Not old chess hustlers.
On the fringes of society a little bit. And so we're sitting next to each other just doing lovey-dovey, you know, cuckoo talk as far as they can tell. Just stroking your face and going, I'm thinking of taking the knight. What do you think? And she go, no. Just push your pawn one more to c4. Just put a bit of pressure on.
This is like a hipster Ocean's 11.
And for me, it was just total dirty talk.
Right.
She's going, push the
pawn. Yeah, that's right. Ironically, you were pretending to do dirty talk, but the chess stuff was turning you
far
on.
Far dirtier than anything he could have thought we were talking about. And we play this guy, and we get beyond the sort of 8 to 10 moves where he'd normally have someone, and you could suddenly see a little change in his demeanour of, uh-oh, these guys can play a bit. And suddenly he's beyond his comfort zone and doesn't know what sort of moves he should be doing. And a few of his mates who've watched their games have finished look over and see that he's given off a bit of that vibe. They come over and just start standing behind him with their hands in their pockets, sledging me.
Oh.
In Ukrainian.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm going, oh, we should do this. And Veronica's just going, ha, ha, you should hear what they're saying about you right now. And we're playing away. And then finally he just pushes one pawn. A square. He just pushes one square forward, and Veronica just goes, ha, got him. And he just ever so slightly overcommitted one of his pieces on one side of the board, and we just dismantled him, took him apart, had a great game, we paid him $20 of the local currency, and so that was just great, and shook his hands and all this sort of stuff, and all the mates wanted to know about me, and she lied and said I'm some guy going off to this big tournament in England and all that sort of stuff.
Brilliant.
But it was this guy and I did not know a word in common. We're 50 years apart in age, living on the opposite sides of the world, totally different people, united over this beautiful little universal language of this board game, right? So chess in itself is just a noble and a beautiful thing. It's a game that you learn a lot from.
So what lessons do you learn from chess then?
That preparation is important, that even when you're ahead, one mistake can stuff everything for you, that unchallenged, unjustified aggression will often lose out to just sensible, patient, someone just taking their time and just waiting. If you just throw your hands around like an idiot, you will eventually make a mistake. And just the beautiful thing about it is that, excuse me, that there's so many pieces and so many moves you can make, unless you're an elite player that none of us will ever be. If you and I had a game of chess now and you understand the rules and we play, that game that's been played just then in the next 15 minutes will be a unique game of chess that has never been played before.
How can that be possible?
The move orders. There's 200 billion different possible games of chess you can play in terms of all the pieces you move.
There's that many?
Yeah.
So how can it be then that people, because when you read about these chess masters, they are able to, like, I just imagine it's like, you know, well, when they made that TV show of Sherlock Holmes, and he looked around the room and then they showed you on the screen everything. I assume that's how they see it, right? They see it all. Like, is that how it works?
No, because they get to a level where of those 200 billion games that we mentioned, 199 billion of those are rubbish.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so within,
if that's a good point.
We can play anything you want, but if you don't know what you're doing, within five moves, they'll take you down. So the only time where... and so if you're at the absolute elite level...
So I could put out a really, really big book of shit chess strategies.
Oh, yeah. Mick, you remember that time? Remember that time we played chess against the guy who came in?
Oh, yeah.
That was Vishyanant. That's the guy who is the world champion at the moment.
Oh.
And we played that game live on air. And I'm trying to remember. I think he won. Didn't he? The time I played, I'm trying to remember. No, he did. He did. He beat me.
My memory's not as good as it could be, but I'm gonna say yes.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember you asking.
Can't believe that people think you're competitive. You're trying to whitewash Vishyanand in his last lap of world championship. He's been holding on. There's this newcomer. He's got full confidence. He thinks he can hold on. And then he hears back from Australia that he lost to some radio dude. Some radio dude's rewriting history.
No, he did beat me, fair and square. Yeah. And so that game,
right?
It's quite possible that game, he's never played that before because I made a few moves and was out of my depth very quickly. But what he's playing against Carlsen the other day, their first game, 16 moves each and they agreed on a draw.
Right.
So they just play a standard opening theory. You have a go at something a bit different. I've thought about it and prepared, bang, and we're good. So that may well be a game that's been played before. But at the level of just competent players, it'll be a unique game of chess.
Okay.
Like literally never happened before with its own stories and
how do you think that relates more broadly to life?
And the other thing about it is if you choose to do it, it is something at which you across your life can constantly strive to be better at.
Right.
And that's really what I think it is for me.
I think, you've struck on something I think that is very important, and I think about quite a lot, is that idea of, I think that we set this, and Todd Sampson talked about it a lot on his, that the path you plan is the path that you won't follow, because we concentrate a lot on end results.
Yeah.
And in my experience, there's never been in my life an end result that has been so satisfying that it has been worth not enjoying all the work it took for that end result.
Yep.
Like, you know, you need to be able to go, being able to get better.
Mm.
Like, I think sometimes that people think that you need to be perfect. Like, you know, new comedians. Like, I've never done a perfect gig. And I'm stumbling by fine.
Mm.
Like, you know, like I want to get better all the time. I always think this is a positive. Every time I do a show, I look at the faults that show had and went, okay, now I know how I can get better at this next time because I can correct those things that I've done wrong this time.
And it also is, it's a constant striving to get better in something that teaches you one of the real rules in life that just simple application will bring about the results. There's a small number of people I'm sure who have a certain genius in perceiving things on a chessboard, but for the vast bulk of people, time in comes to time out. You've seen I've got a guitar in the study here, and I'd done a charity gig in Brisbane for Red Kite, the kids' cancer charity that we help out. And that night, the person who'd spoken at the event was a music therapist. Music therapists go into hospitals where kids are going to be for a long time and just sing songs to them and maybe help the kids write music back and all that sort
Fantastic.
Of stuff. Fantastic. Yeah, and music therapy works for either troubled, disadvantaged kids. My wife's on the board of something called the ACMF, Australian Children's Music Foundation. Don Spencer, former play school, that sort of stuff, which takes music lessons into detention centres and all that and just gives kids something to look forward to and express themselves. And similar for some kid who's got cancer and is going to be in hospital for the next 5 months, just a couple of hours a week of singing songs, either for the really young kids so they're not scared or for the slightly older kids who can make their own music. It's wonderful stuff. She'd spoken about that. And I was flying home and my elder girl, Ellie would have been maybe 2, and I don't think Olivia had been born yet, or maybe had just been born and Ellie was 3. And I'm flying home thinking, I couldn't even sing Bar Bar Black Sheep with him. Can't be that hard, can it, to hold down a couple of chords on a guitar?
Right.
So the plane lands at Sydney Airport and I'm driving home. I think, who do I know who plays the guitar? Who do I know? Oh, I actually do know Murray Cook from the Wiggles because he lives not far from our place and we've spoken a couple of times.
So not only did you say, who do I know who plays guitar? You were like, who do I know who plays guitar and knows a few kids' songs?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Who would my kids most want me to be?
Yeah.
Murray from the Wiggles.
Yeah.
And so rang him. And I said, I'm thinking of getting a guitar. And he said, and there's a place just up the road from where I live, and he's not far from me. He said, you just go to Pete's, the musician's market there on King Street, and, you know, get a blah, blah. So I've left on the Friday morning to go and do this gig. I've arrived back Saturday lunchtime, walking in the same door as my wife saw me leave, with my small suitcase of luggage in one hand and a guitar in the other. And Mel doesn't miss a beat. That's why I love her. She just looks up and goes, hi. Oh, you've brought your midlife crisis home with you, have you?
I'm leaving radio and I'm going on the road.
Get in the band. And so
The bad news is I don't have a secure job anymore. The good news is I'm now the most unpopular Wiggle.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm writing a lot of songs about maths and I'm taking them on the road.
This guitar has been recommended to me by Murray. And so
it's called a blah blah. I had not
picked up a guitar before the age of about 40.
Yeah.
And by the age of 40, most of the things you're doing in your life, you're good at, or you wouldn't be doing them.
Right.
You know, if you crap at something.
And it's rare that you start something, despite the fact that we all, I want to learn the amount of, I think the last 4 years, I've gone, I'm going to learn a new language this year. And just other
stuff gets
in the way.
If you're no good at tennis, you've given it up by the time you're 40.
Yeah.
Right. I would say that about everything in my life, except perhaps love making that I still work on. But,
like chess.
And one day we'll, at least get a ranking.
Sometimes it's over in 16 moves. And they both agree to draw and step away.
Exactly. And I have done some things in the bedroom that are they've never been done before. Completely unique. Anyway.
And once with Vishyanan.
Exactly.
On the couch, but that's another story.
I've been in time trouble before.
Right.
Anyway. And so I went through that at age 40.
Yeah.
Yeah, of every single person, the first time you pick up a guitar, you are terrible.
Terrible.
Beyond terrible.
Terrible.
And can't make sense. It hurts your hands and
plenty
all that.
Plenty of people in bands are still terrible.
But I went through that whole thing of actually thinking, oh, maybe I am in that 1% of people who just can't.
Right.
Okay. And are stuck at it.
And how did you feel about that? Like, were you frustrated by that? Yeah, was there a point where you decided,
really?
You thought, stuff it. I'm an adult. I don't need to play this guitar. You're
really,
not better than me, guitar.
It's really frustrating. And you're strumming at it and you'll get angry at yourself and literally just, oh, for fuck! Fucking go there! And you're shouting at your fingers as though it's someone else's fault.
Right.
It's probably mine.
Probably.
My fingers.
I mean, well.
I'm the one who's trying to put them there.
Yep.
But then you get these little breakthroughs and then you suddenly, there was this time when I remembered I'd gone from being unlistenable to ponderous.
Right.
And that was just
great.
Glorious.
Yeah.
But I used to sit on on the old couch that I conceived my first daughter on.
Yeah.
I just watched the ABC News every night, and during the half hour of the news, would sit there and just without a pick, just softly with the fingers, strum and try and hold. So doing half an hour a night, surprisingly by myself, no one else wanted to watch the news. Great way to get
watch the news with a little acoustic guitar in the background.
Great stuff. And me,
you didn't pitch that to ABC 24.
Me occasionally swearing.
Here's your new idea for your breakfast show. Virginia Trioli on the couch while I just strum in the background.
Exactly. You can stream it. It's great. And it's a pop-up digital station. But then eventually, just through no talent, just time in, application leading to result, I'm like competent at it now.
Yeah.
And so I can look at chords of a song and I can hear it. Other people can't necessarily. But it's got to the point where it's quite enjoyable. And that process, and chess teaches you that as well, or just having something that teaches you that is really a salutary lesson.
The ability to complete something, I think, is important. I speak to people quite a lot about the idea of I like that I went to university, even though halfway through university I knew that I was never going to use my journalism degree. But I enjoyed the fact that I got out of my uni degree and I'd learnt that I could finish something. That's the thing about it that – I finished that, then maybe when I go on and do something else, I can also, finish that, use those same skills.
Yeah, absolutely. And also with things like playing the guitar and or playing chess are a little bit more open-ended than that, but things that there are...
Well, you can still get better
exactly.
at them. Like you're ongoing.
Completely.
Which I think is actually one of the great thrills of life is I think that's why people are I've never been fascinated by golf. Hmm. But from the people I know who like golf, that's what I hear that they like about golf is the idea that you're getting good at a skill that you're never going to master.
Yeah, and it's also having yourself in a certain circumstance and realizing 6 months ago, I would have fucked that. I would have stuffed that up entirely. As it was, played a nice little chip shot. Tapped it in. And the great thing about golf, I've played a tiny bit, you'll go around a course in 120 shots and you'll remember four of them.
Right.
You'll remember four glorious shots. Then the other 116 do fade away. I was playing in a charity golf day once for the Swans, and there was a guy organising. So we're all in groups of four, and we're going around this course. And so we start on about the sixth hole, and we're going around. We're going to finish eventually on the fifth, having done all 18, because it's loaded up with 70-odd players. This guy's just standing on the balcony of the first, just watching as people tee off on the first, welcoming them all. How are you going? Great, have a good day. And he's the sort of guy who would be judgmental, slightly harsh, but he would note how you can do things.
Right.
Sort of, and as we're walking up, having done the 18th, about to start on the first, Adam, how are you going? How are you hitting him? And I said, oh, you know, so-so, nothing special. And we're in this group of four, and as luck would have it on that tee, I was the last to hit. These other three guys are all quite competent golfers, hit it, and I'm like, I can, if I'm playing golf with someone who knows what they're doing, I won't slow them down horrendously, but I'm by no stretch of the imagination any good at golf.
Uh-huh.
Put this ball down, I hit it, it's as sweet as I've ever hit a golf ball in my life. It's gone and landed at the furthest of the other three balls. It's landed just past that on the full, bounced on another 40, 50 metres, dead straight. Like, honestly,
right,
if you'd given a professional the shot, they might have said, oh, I'll take that.
Yep.
It's all right.
Yeah, lock that in.
Like, and, yeah. So I've hit it like that, and I'm about to start this whooping big victory dance, and then...
Which would betray you as not being a professional.
So I just turned to him and said, like I said, mate, so-so, nothing special. And walked down that fairway thinking, he will never see me hit another fucking ball in my life.
Right.
He will go to his grave thinking that's what I consider a so-so shot.
Oh, I have friends like that about my comedy. I have friends who came out, like real friends of mine, yeah, lifelong friends of mine, friends and family, who came to my first ever comedy festival shows and have never come back. Now, firstly, I understand that because I was there. I know what they were like.
Yeah.
But the second thing is I've got better.
Yeah.
Like,
come
it's
on.
I'm demonstrably better. I will give you free tickets to something that is actually worth something now.
Yeah. If you'd invited them out to another gig a fortnight later, yeah, you could understand their trepidation.
Right.
Assuming 15 years on...
How bad were those gigs that 20 years on they are still not willing to...
Either you've got a wealthy benefactor who really doesn't check up on you that much, or you're doing all right now.
But that's an interesting perspective, I think, which is that that's their only perspective, yeah, of having seen me do comedy.
Mm.
So often, you know, the broad picture of our life is not what various people within our lives see.
Yeah.
The people at work see a different you to the people at home see a different you to, yeah, by the very nature of those things.
And
right?
The only thing I would say also in that sort of broad umbrella of philosophies, and with me at the moment it's the chess and the guitar. I'm finishing, yeah, up Breakfast Road at the end of this year, and I'm really excited that by the end of next year, I'm going to be a much better chess player than I am,
right,
now, and a much better guitar player. And I'll have, with the chess, there's this website called chess.com,
yep,
where you go and you can play games against people around the world. They have a puzzles page where it just throws you a situation on a chessboard and you have to say what the best move is. And you're timed and you've got a points ranking. And I'm currently at like 1,550 or something. I've been as high as 1,650 and dropped down to 1,400. And you can't, if you quickly just go and try a puzzle because you've got a spare minute, you've really got to lock yourself in.
Right.
It's best to do like about an hour.
Yeah.
And after about, if I try and do an hour, after about 45 minutes, I get on a real roll. Then I start making some stupid mistakes because I'm tired. But you can feel that time of how long before I get tired getting pushed back a little bit. So I'm locking in next year for, I'm doing 3 2-hour sessions a week, regardless of where I am, what I'm doing, 3 2-hour sessions of problems on this website.
So. I love, it's like when a sports person retires, they're like, I want to spend more time with my family.
Mm-hmm.
You've retired from radio because you want to spend more time with your chessboard.
Absolutely. And so that and the guitar are two things next year that I'm currently trying to get better at.
So, but okay, so let's talk about the idea of like leaving the radio, because this is a big, like it's a momentous, well, at least externally, it seems to people to be a momentous moment in your life. You're, mm-hmm, a guy who's had a couple of really long-term successful radio stints basically in a row.
Yep.
You know, from the public's, mm-hmm, perspective, basically in a row. And then you're stepping away from that. Is that a decision that came very easily to you? When you make decisions, how do you make them? Are you a person who goes on your gut, or is it a thing that, you know, you need to discuss with Mel? Is it a thing that you sit down and write a list of pros and cons? Mm. Like, how do you process a big life decision like that?
I had promised Mel that by the end of next year, 2014, I'd be finished. And it was just a matter of when. And we had admittedly...
You've brought it in under target.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You should be running the country out.
Well, no, surely she will.
did you do a budget, mini budget estimate?
And a MIFO. If you were sitting here, if she was sitting here now, she would point out to you that wasn't the first time we'd made a deal on when it was going to finish.
Oh, okay.
So I brought in the...
It got extended for a couple of seasons.
I brought in Series 3 under budget. Right. Series 1 and 2 might have run a little bit long.
I see.
But I decided by the end of next year it was going to be done. And then for me with big decisions like that, I tend to just suddenly realise. And it's, as I said on air when I announced it, as someone who dreams of sporting glory and rarely performs at above sporting mediocrity, there is a bit of an analogy with the athlete. You just suddenly realise one day, I realised I'll be fine till the end of this year. I really can't guarantee I'd be good at the end of 2014. And it's not like other jobs where you can just in the middle of June say, look, I'll give you 6 weeks' notice. I'll be out of here in the second week of August. You can't do that. You've really got to run a year with Breakfast Radio.
You could get the Prime Minister on and ask if their boyfriend was gay.
Yep.
That tends to...
See you later.
I'll just be back in my bags, guys.
And I also do get quite logical about that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a big decision in some ways, but...
Because, I mean, externally, you're looking at something, you're hosting what was often the number one AM breakfast show in Sydney, Australia's biggest city. You're talking...
Only ever second biggest.
You're talking... Oh, only ever second show. Biggest? Yeah. Oh, of course, never Alan Jones. Sorry, oh, well, yeah, that's right.
My one...
Well, I mean,
slight regret.
Okay, but a very, very high rating.
Solid, very solid. Yeah.
And you're talking to all of Sydney. Yep. I imagine it's a position that comes with like some perceived power, even if it's not power that you choose to exercise that often.
I will certainly have, as Gareth Evans referred to it, when Hawke's government lost power, the Keating government as it then was, to John Howard, you'll go through relevance deprivation syndrome.
And how do you feel about relevance deprivation syndrome?
Well, the thing is, The logic, the logician in me kicks in and says, look, I'm 45 next year, so this was going to happen sometime in the next couple of years. I haven't, at the age of 58, decided, do I want to throw this in or should I just run two more years here and I'm done and never need, want to do anything else? So I was always going to go on to something new.
Okay.
So then it just becomes a time of, well, logically, you have to make that decision at some time. I'd rather make that decision now than in a year from now when I'd be less happy. And if you stayed, as you would remember with the Triple J times, if you stay 1 year too long in Breakfast Radio, you'll hate the last 3 or 4 months so much, you'll forget why you loved the first 7 or 8 years so much. So it then becomes this logical process for me of you have to decide to stop this either now or a year from now. They're the only two choices you've really got. Which of those is the better choice to make? Do this.
Did you have a plan in place for what would happen afterwards, or did you then have to put that in place? Because if we go back to when we finished up at Triple J, I know that, it was more about that we thought it was time to finish doing the show rather than either of us just going, well, this is definitely what I'm going to do next.
No, I didn't have much of a plan.
No, lucky you knocked up your wife.
Exactly, exactly. Well, then at the time, the fact that Mel was pregnant was something that in a way meant I'm certainly not going to be sitting around wondering what to do with myself.
Right, but at the same time, there must have been some sort of pressure of going, I have to make sure that I can look after this situation financially. And sometimes in that situation, people can make decisions on staying on a job another year if it's a safe opportunity.
Yeah, but you wait till, I finish on December 6th and I have a range of product endorsements coming out on December 7th. That'll make it very clear. Have I already mentioned chess.com? If there's one place... kids, that you want to go to get the very best in chess problems, chess.com is the website to go to.
You can tell Adam's enjoying not being on the ABC talking for a minute. You can plug as much as you want on a free podcast.
Exactly.
In fact, if chess.com free. Want to get on...
It's free, but I'm getting paid.
Oh, yeah. No, I meant free for the public.
Thank you.
Oh, it costs me thousands a year.
That's as long as I'm getting paid for my appearance here. So I'm happy to endorse whatever product that was.
Yeah, chess.com.
Yeah, chess.
Chess.com for all your chess needs.
That Diet Coke's going down well, isn't it?
The Diet Coke is going down well. Yeah. It's probably terrible for us though, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you what's not terrible. The new BMW X5. Fuck me. It handles well, I've been told.
Proud sponsors of Willosophy Episode 3 coming soon.
And I saw parallels with it in my life at university where the notional end goal. So, like, I started at university in an arts law degree.
Yep.
Simply because I was really good at debating in high school, and someone's mum told me, if you're good at debating, you should probably do law.
Right.
And then dropped all my art subjects except for mathematics, which I'd simply pick because I knew it wouldn't be that hard, so I could cruise through that bit of university.
They are not sentences that are often used.
Dropped all my – oh, mate, I found mathematics so much easier than philosophy and economics and whatever else I was doing. Dropped all the law subjects and then law and realised I really didn't want to do that. Stuck around at maths because I didn't want to leave uni yet, and then ended up starting a PhD, which I didn't finish. So by any sort of strict criteria, as an academic university degree, wasn't crackingly successful.
Did you ever have like ambitions of what you thought you like? Take me back to, you know, Adam Spencer at high school. Like, well, no, take me back to where Adam Spencer learned how to play chess, and we'll take it from there, seeing that's the, you know, analogy we're using.
I learned how to play chess when I was about 5 or 6 because the guy who lived next door to us, whose name was almost certainly Terry MacArthur, broke his leg really badly in a workplace accident and had like 3 months or something rehab next door with the old full leg cast, couldn't get off the chair and was just bored out of his brain, and said to my mum, send Adam over and I'll teach him how to play checkers. And she said he already knows how to play checkers, so he taught me how to play chess. And I'm guessing I'm about 5 or 6 years old, and I can still vaguely remember him. He looked a little bit like, from what I recall, Sam Simmons.
Right.
Comedy Mate, the big thick...
Hang on, so your parents let you hang out with a guy who looked like Sam Simmons when you're 5 to play games? This is terribly irresponsible parenting.
He was completely immobilised.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was in a cast. Yeah.
Or
Adam, always sit lunging distance away from Terry.
Yeah. You don't have to run back here. Just run.
Just run.
Just run laps of the house. Why I'm so fit these days. So he taught me how to play chess, so it would have been just maybe starting school. But my parents, you know, and you met them both, lovely, wonderful people, but I've said publicly before, my dad dropped out of high school in like year 9.
Right, and I think it's important to tell these stories because, I mean, I was the first person in my family to finish high school. Mm. Todd Sampson told us last episode that neither of his parents could read at one stage.
Yeah, that was amazing.
So, like, I think it's important to kind of share these things so people, you know, understand that you don't have to come from some family where your mum was a doctor and your dad was a lawyer, and it's fine if you do also, but, that's not everybody's story.
No, and there's no doubt at all that trajectory is heavily influenced by privilege in a lot of cases. But
entrenched.
Yeah, you can buck that system occasionally. So my dad dropped out of school in year 9 because he had really bad asthma and had to go to hospital for injected steroids and all that, and there was no point going back. My mum dropped out of school before she'd started high school because her family situation was very, very difficult. So I was the first kid in my family to finish high school.
Wow.
And first one to go to university.
Yep.
Trace the tree as wide as you want. So picked arts, law, but had no idea what that meant or where that was meant to be going. And it was
I'm doing 9 years to make up for the fact that none of you have
exactly,
been.
Exactly.
I'm doing 3 years for you, Dad.
Exactly.
I'm doing 3 years for you, Mum.
Yeah, I'm not going to finish anything while I'm there, but this 5th, 6th, and 7th year, they're for you, Mum.
Yeah.
So my parents were great because they spotted early on that I was doing all right academically. And from even early in primary school and through high school and university, they would always back. If I made a decision, I remember telling them I was not doing law anymore, I was going to do mathematics, and then I was going to do a PhD in mathematics, I'm going to drop out of mathematics and go into the media at Triple J and that sort of stuff. And I remember them always thinking, well, if you need any advice, I'll help you here for you, but we'll back any decisions you want to make on that. But for me, that even when I was at university and not necessarily moving in a straight line towards an end goal, I was always, as it turns out, and sometimes quite accidentally, but doing something that was really worthwhile. Like the debating I did at university turned out to be great for me, the theatre sports that I hosted at university and all that sort of stuff. So I don't particularly care if people make a decision in life to stop and do something new or decide something's not the right thing for them. But one philosophy would be, and one thing I'm going to try and encourage in the kids, is always be doing something, no matter how inane it might seem, that you're happy with it and you think is making you a better person or just enjoying your life more. And it can be as, you know, the world's not going to, you know, float or sink on whether I can belt out a few guitar chords, but it's been great for me for the last 5 years to be pushing myself to be better at that.
It's always amazing at what ends up coming in handy though as well.
Yep.
Often, you know, you'll find in entertainment, you know, someone will get a job on something because, you know, like a sports show comes up and they need not only someone who's a comedian, but they need someone who's a really passionate sports fan. You can't then just study up on being a sports fan. It has to go to the person who genuinely has a passion for that thing. So I think part of, you know, life is having a broader amount of things that you can do and keeping your options open a bit on where you can go with those things.
And given that we all, you know, despite increased life expectancy and our ability to multitask, have a finite number of hours on the planet, and you certainly don't want to be working 24/7 all the time on stuff. You do need some time just to be sitting around vegging doing zip. But if at the end of your life you're told this is how much time you spent sitting around doing absolutely fuck all, absolutely nothing, I don't know many, you know, save Justice Michael Kirby on the High Court, who does wish he'd spent a bit more time just doing jack in his life. You don't meet that many people who in their closing days go, yeah, should have done nothing a bit more. Should have really...
Really should have got a wee.
Really should have wasted a bit more of my time just punching a few bucket bongs on the couch and not...
I thought you were talking about wasting time.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. You've confused me now. So talk me through then, because I think people would be interested in this. You're at university. How does Triple J happen? Because that doesn't seem like, you know, being an entertainer was, even though you were clearly entertaining. You went to the World Debating Championships. In fact, you were named the best debater at the World Debating Championships. 1996. Is that right?
World's best speaker in 1996.
Yeah.
Hello, ladies.
Right. Yeah. But no, but obviously you liked the idea of...
No, I could yak, and my debating style was a very entertaining one. We had theatre sports at Sydney Uni, which was great fun. And at the time that I was hosting theatre sports at Sydney Uni, you just had this crop. Admittedly, I was there for a little while, so I probably saw a wider array. But you had Rob Carlton, Andrew O'Keefe, Rebecca de Unamuno, Julian Morrow, Charles Firth, Craig Rucastle, the whole Chaser gang. Me and the Chaser gang were the creative force behind the Uni Arts Review in 95 and 96, which brought that back. It hadn't been on for almost 20 years. It was right. Clive James and all those in the 70s.
Gritty reboot.
And the Chaser guy said, well, let's do it. You know, that's another excuse for not studying for the next 6 months. Let's do an arts review. We did a couple of those back to back. And this guy called Andrew Hansen came in one day, could play guitar and piano and sing songs and all that. So it was that sort of environment. And then one year at the end of the year, after the theatre sports had finished, that the Tuesday lunchtimes had just been packed in the bar, and they said, can you guys do anything for the remaining 6 weeks of the semester? And we said, let's have a student stand-up comedy competition. I'll just keep emceeing. And we just got all the kids who are smart asses around the place. You come up with, it's called 5 minute noodles.
Right.
You had to come up with anything up to 5 minutes of stuff. And remember Charles Firth did like hilariously funny one time when he had forgotten he was on.
Right.
And he thought he was on the next week. And I said, you're on this week. And he just got up and with a newspaper and was just reading things out of the paper and saying, that's fascinating. And just turning to the classifieds and going, it's a dot matrix print. I only want $85. It's a fantastically reasonable price. Anyway, just looking through the paper, and you got through to the next round on that because it was pretty weak. But emceeing that, where it could be anything from that, through Tom Gleason started
right.
it. Tom Gleason turned up with a drum kit and was because he was in a band.
That's right.
And he used to crack jokes in between the songs. So he sat there cracking jokes, doing his own sort of stuff. Sarah Kendall came through that competition. So I was emceeing that.
Well, can we just linger on that for a second then before we go into what happened next? How important do you think that being part of a creative generation and group of people is, like, in regard to creativity? Because you often look at, I know in comedy, and that's the world that I, you know, have grown up in, you find that, like, it tends to come through in generations.
Yeah.
You know, I back in the day, you know, when I was doing the elbow grease room that, you know, 60 people would come to on a Sunday and none of us got paid. But, you know, every single week it'd be Husey and myself and Rove and Hallier and Merrick and Rosso and Tripod and Michelle Laurie and, you know, Corinne Grant and all these people who went on to, but not just them, the people around it, the guy who produced the show, the, you know, some people around, like people like Miff Warhurst and people who were our friends around that time, and it comes through. Do you think it's important?
Part of me endorses in principle why that would be important, but the rigorous logical mathematician in me doubts the existence of those waves. I think a lot of that happens in hindsight.
Right.
I think if you look at all those people, it's not like if you and Husey and Justin Hamilton and ... had all walked into a club on the one night or within a fortnight of each other, and 10 years later blah, blah. If there are a group of guys in the Australian cricket team now who were within 6 months of age of each other, you'd go, that's incredible.
Right.
But there's probably so much overlap there. There's probably people a lot younger than you who consider they've come through in the same generation as you.
Uh-huh.
And there'd be a few old bastards who are 48 saying, yeah, I'm part of Will's crew.
Right.
And now that spans 20 years all
of a sudden.
It's
a very good point.
And so I don't know if it happens as, like, you look back at Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie bumped into each other in those Footlight reviews, and there are some amazingly funny people in those. But I'm sure in the ones either side there were also some, you know, if you have, you see it sometimes in the World Cup of football,
yep,
where there's a nation who makes the World Cup finals on the back of this amazing group of people who are all the same age,
yep,
then you don't hear of that country again for a long time. But I think in your artistic sort of things, it's probably easier to get the impression there's this massive wave that just happens in the click of a finger that probably has a fair bit more smearing on the age spread.
I like that perspective because it's not, certainly not one that I've ever considered. Yeah. I've always been a big subscriber to the idea of, like, I looked at the D-Gen and that generation, yeah, and the things, you know, because you sparked off each other creatively, but I kind of understand what you mean as well.
But it is good. I mean, one thing that is important in that sort of stuff is having it early on an environment where you do learn that maxim of how important just hard work is and being able to work hard. Myself, Rob Carlton and Andrew O'Keefe did a show for about 8 weeks at a local pub in sort of Chippendale, down near the SCG, the Bat and Ball Hotel. Rob just said, we would come out of the theatre sports thing and said, let's just do it. And it was sort of a 90-minute show each Wednesday night, and it was a mixture of just straight-out jokes, character play. We have a debate in the middle of each of it.
Andrew O'Keefe would have some suitcases and ask people to
bit of impro, the whole thing. And it was 90 minutes of new material every week.
Wow.
And Rob Carlton decided to call it Lick Me, I Know You're Dirty. That was the name of the show. At least people did tend to notice when it was on. And I think we did like eight of them or something like that. But it was an hour and a half of new material every week. This is about 1995, 96.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting in my room at college at uni, just staring at a blank piece of paper with the show on in 2 days, and just forced ourselves to work hard enough to have that stuff ready. So where I think that creative environment thing works is it does help people who have the potential, if they work hard enough at it, to do something, to have a place to do that. And so for me, when I was at uni doing all the – so I was emceeing the student stand-up gigs. And if it was – if Tom Gleason finished and had killed it and up next was Sarah Kendall, I'd literally go, that was Tom. Here's Sarah Kendall. But if someone got up and died badly, I really needed to say something
right,
to fill in the gaps.
Yeah, of course.
And so over 5 or 6 weeks, there were a few gaps
right,
to fill in. So I'd become more confident actually just straight out telling jokes. And around that time, Triple J had their first ever Raw Comedy.
Right.
And the very first year they did it, they actually had a general category and a university category.
Oh, okay, yeah,
and
right.
And I went in the very first year of that.
Who won the general category? Did you know?
Was it Anthony Manchetti?
Okay, yeah, Anthony Manchetti. That could be it. Yeah,
he won it. It was a bit weird because he won it. I think he won it, and then I sort of came second in the uni category.
Right.
I think, but I don't know if being in the uni category you also qualified for the, but I won New South Wales and went down to Melbourne for that.
Okay, right.
And so I hopped on the big stage of the Comedy Festival and was in the, I didn't win the whole thing, but went pretty well at that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Triple J came to Sydney Uni not long after that and did a breakfast show. And I was still studying at the uni, and it's Mikey Robbins and Helen Razor and all that. And they got me up on stage knowing that I'd be reasonable. And so I was just faffing on about uni and all that sort of stuff, and had revealed that I was doing a PhD in pure math at the uni.
Right.
And it came time to do the weather, and they asked me if I'd read the weather. And I said, yeah, and, you know, Newcastle's sunny and 16. And Helen Razor leapt in with, hey, maths boy, if you're so smart, if you're so funny, why don't you tell me something interesting about all these numbers in the weather? Over to you. And it was like 20 to 7 in the morning, and
yep,
this had not been run by me beforehand.
No. You're on the fly.
I'm literally, you know, Brisbane fine and 25, that's 5 squared. Townsville fine and 19, prime number, lives next door to 20. Newcastle, sunny and 16, that's 2 to the power of 4 and 4 to the power of 2. The only number that can be written in reverse power formation, Euler proved that, back in the 1770s, just on a roll,
right?
And ended up doing really well with that sort of stuff. And there was a string. I remember, used to talk about this on stage. There was a string of places in the weather that were all like the last four or five places were all 22 degrees,
right?
And rather than think, well, fuck, I might just say one of them.
They're all 22 and then go with it.
Oh, yeah, or I might just say one of them's 21 or 23, as if you know, the good people of Perth are going to notice. No, it had to be true to the numbers. That's just, there's only so many things you can say about 22. You know, 2 times 11, square root of 484, number of people in a particularly violent game of rugby league where there's been two people sent off on each side, and yeah, and finally and saying it was the cube root of however many degrees that it was, blah, blah. And they thought that was funny and came in and started doing a little bit of filling stuff on Triple J from there.
So that's one of those classic examples of what you were talking about earlier, though, isn't it? About you never know. It's about being good at a bunch of things and getting as many experiences as you can. And then sometimes those things are going to come together, because if you had not done all that work on maths and your passion in maths, and you had not done all that improv stuff and stage stuff, you wouldn't have in that moment had that perfect storm, because she didn't ask you to just, can you be funny between the weather? She was like, can you be funny about maths in the weather? Now, it could have been someone there who had the skills to know the maths and come up with a story, but didn't have the presence. I imagine there's probably a bunch of people in the maths world who could nail those numbers, but might
that,
not
that
have
16
the...
16 being 2 to the power of 4 isn't a well-kept, not a well-kept secret in the mathematical world.
Right, I think
it's out there.
I think they'd
it
be fine
public.
With 22 being 2 times 11. But they might not be able to present it in the same way. But if anyone ever said, how, and people do say this to me all the time, how do I get a job on Triple J? I can't say, well, look, all you need to do is be really good at math, be a world champion debater, and then wait for a perfect storm.
Exactly. The other thing I do occasionally look at when the stuff that I've been lucky enough to do, which does really blow my mind occasionally, is that there was I would not be doing what I'm doing now if another, not even a friend of mine, a guy I knew at uni had finished his degree.
I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
I will talk you through it. I was at uni and I was on the student union. I was president of the student union.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I want to run for the Senate for the university.
What I love also, by the way, is I think for anyone who's starting to work out why Adam didn't finish his uni degree, it might be because he was doing everything you could do at uni apart from your university
studies. So I'm president of the student union, and I'm thinking the Senate is the governing body of the university.
Uh-huh.
And there's a spot on the Senate for an undergraduate and the spot on the Senate for a postgraduate.
Uh-huh.
And the election was coming up for the undergraduate on the Senate. So I went around and got all these nomination form filled out, including a mate of mine, Nick, and the 20 nominees, filled it out, went and dropped it in at the office, went off on I was going on a debating tour, that's right, representing the university in debating in 1992 and down in Adelaide where we won, and went away, came, and whilst I was gone, the nomination period was closing, got back, looked at the list of nominees on the official uni notice board, and my name wasn't there. And I went in and said, I'm nominated for this. I handed a form in. And they went, oh, no, you're a – nah, here we go. It's this guy, Nick. He's not an enrolled student. He's dropped out of uni. I said, but he filled out the form, and I went to Adelaide. How was I?
Right.
Sorry, mate, you have to have 20 nominees. You can't run in this election. But I – oh, okay. So at the end of – if I'd run in that election, I'm pretty confident I would have won the spot of undergraduate on the Senate. At the end of that year, which was my final honours year in maths, I would not have been able to go and do my PhD in mathematics. I would have had to go and finish my law degree if I'd wanted to hold that spot on the Senate. And I think if push had come to shove and people had said, you can be on the Senate, you'd have to keep doing law, or you could throw all that away and, you know, piss around on a maths PhD if you wanted, I probably would have said, look, the sensible thing to do here is to finish my law degree, because I really want to be on the Senate, and wouldn't that be fun? So the whole maths thing, I would have gone down to uni, would have gone into the Senate, would have finished my law degree, had already at that stage been made a job offer from a big corporate law firm, which I think I would have gone and done.
And so and obviously this is pure speculation, but let's talk through that sliding doors moment.
Yeah.
Where do you imagine that guy would have gone? Do you think he would have found his way to the world that you've kind of found your way to anyway, or do you think that would have just been a completely different path for you?
Yeah, I don't think I would have, because it was only that it was 3 or 4 years later that those stand-up comedy and all those opportunities presented themselves, and that I was old enough to think I'll give this a go, having no idea of what the law degree was before I started or where law was meant to send you, but feeling this, not sense of responsibility, but knowing that, you know, it was lucky for me to go to university.
Right.
And if the system had told me, well, the system was telling me, look, you're at university, you're a world champion debater, and it was the late 80s, early 90s, you are corporate law, mate. You are
right.
Gordon Gekko.
Perfect.
You have to, this is what you are born to do. Fuck, you're on the Senate of the University of Sydney, the people you've met now, and blah, 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 and sons want you to go in their intern program. Dude, this is what
you're meant to do.
This is what you are clearly meant to do.
So how do you in those moments, and how do you do this with your own children as well, like, you know, give them support and encouragement but not put so many expectations on someone that they get trapped into a life that they don't want to be doing? Because I think a lot of people feel that. They're not really doing the thing they want to do. They're doing it because they feel like they owe their parents something, or they're too scared to tell their parents what they really want to do, or they're good at something. The amount of people who I feel like are trapped in careers because they're good at them.
Yeah.
They don't really like them.
Yeah.
They're good at them and they think,
sufficiently good at it not to really hate it.
Right.
And that it pays the bills, but not necessarily good enough at it, but it doesn't gel with them sufficiently that they enjoy it.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my kids are only 8 and 5, so we've only had so many career discussions so far.
Well, but I'm interested. I'm interested even in that.
We've had a couple.
Yeah, no, but I am interested in that because clearly you will have a philosophy of how you raise your children. And I'm not looking for personal details, but I just think that you, I bet you think about this. I know that when Mel was pregnant the first time and we were doing the radio together, you would come in every day with a different fact or stat about, you know, where you were up to in the pregnancy and what was going on and what you'd learnt that day. So I imagine as a parent, you've probably done, are you an instinctive parent, or are you a parent who's like, you know, read some information, has a real distinct philosophy of how you think you're going to encourage them to, you know, develop as humans?
No, we're one of the things I'm lucky about with the breakfast radio that I've done all the kids' lives effectively is that whilst you're up really early in the morning, you're here by 2 in the afternoon. So I paraphrase it as, I never take my kids to school. I pick them up almost every day.
Right.
Now, this afternoon when they finish school, I'm over at school taking the chess club that I set up there that both my girls are in, a few of their mates and all that sort of stuff. So having enough time with the kids is not something I have to worry about. I'm more in the camp of, dude, you should probably ease off and let your kids just play with their mates a bit, and don't worry if they've done that extra maths homework that you've asked them to do, even though it's not in the classes.
Right. So that, but I think that that is something you would have to be careful about.
Oh yeah,
because you don't want to be that parent, you know.
Totally, totally. But the one thing I'm really open with the elder girl about, Olivia's only 5 and doesn't really understand it yet, but Ellie and I regularly have conversations where I say to her, "You realise that this is the first time I've ever done this." And so I don't really know what a dad's meant to do. If you want, why don't you tell me what do I do really good as a dad, and what could I do a bit better? And they're just awesome conversations.
Again, I don't need to know too much, but do you have some examples of those things? Yeah, because I'd love to.
She'll say, you know, I love that you love me, and I love that you tell me that you love me, and I know how busy your job is, and I know that you always read us a story at night, no matter how tired you are, and that I really, really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'll say something like, but maybe I don't have to play chess every day.
Right. You are the dummy Dokic of chess.
Maybe I could just hang out with my friends a little bit more, or whatever. And they're beautiful, beautiful conversations to have.
Interesting though, because I think that sometimes people wouldn't think of like consulting their child on how you're doing as a father.
Yeah. Well, I get the impression by the time she turns about 12 and a half,
no,
it'll be about 8 years where we won't have those sort of discussions.
You might as well get some chats in now.
But
does that terrify you as well? Because you do have 2 daughters, and without like wanting to, you know, devolve into that cliche, you can have great relationships with kids, and then they get to like a part of their life where, you know, they're changing and they're dealing with how they're changing, and for whatever reason, dad doesn't get to be involved in some of that. Does that scare you, or do you think that's going to be okay?
You know, it's with any of those things. You hear the very worst story of how difficult those things can be, and you wouldn't wish those on anyone. And you then meet some people who say, mate, I didn't even notice, they were in their troublesome teenage years. So you don't know. It's interesting because your parents, and by the nature of you being a kid, your parents project you as just all-seeing, all-knowing. And we all remember those first times when you realise, fuck, my dad doesn't actually know everything in the world.
Right.
Or remember when you play a game and you're saying...
I'm guessing that came earlier for you than it came from
no,
me.
No, but you know, my dad will just pick up the world and drop it on your dad.
Right.
Oh, well, my dad will pick up your dad picking up the world on that sort of stuff. And or the first time you realise, wow, I'm at an age now where athletically I could do something better.
Oh, yeah, I could beat him in something.
If we actually ran as fast as we could to that tree. Now, Ellie, who's 8 and coming on 9, loves swimming. And we... I can swim in a way that I'm totally safe and won't drown in the water.
Right.
And I've done 1 kilometre ocean swims, but I swim from I look like an 85-year-old man who every stroke could be his last.
Right.
I almost drowned when I was really young in a bath, and when I learnt to swim, just didn't want to put my head in the water at all.
Mm.
So I swim now entirely arms.
Right.
I kick if I want, but it doesn't make any difference because my legs are dragging down almost perpendicular.
That could have, in a different universe, turned you into a crime-fighting ocean dweller.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, not the case on Earth. It just turns me into a guy who will never do a triathlon, even if I was an Olympic cyclist. So Ellie loves swimming.
Yep.
And the other day, we hopped in a pool and just swam 50 metres with each other. I said, well, you know, let's have a race.
Yep.
And she knew what it was, you know. And so she's going as fast as she can, and I'm swimming alongside her. Just enough to be in front, then let her miraculously finish and tap the wall. She doesn't realise how close she was to... I gave her the impression I was putting in 5%.
Right.
I was probably putting in 60.
Yeah.
If she goes to this little swim club a couple of times a week...
You probably should have taken the victory. You should have got one in while you still had it left in you.
She's about to turn 9. If she keeps practising sometime in the age that she's 10... she'll beat me in a 50-metre swim.
That's interesting.
There's no doubt about that at all.
I mean, we could keep talking all day, but I don't want to get bogged down in stuff that people can already hear, and I know that we have to finish up reasonably soon. I want to talk about, and you've touched on the idea of how you're raising your kids, but more broadly than that, something that people might not know about you is how active you are in like that sort of charity world. Mm. Like, and so where did that come from? Where does the idea of like, you know, wanting to help other people, where do you get interested in that? Is that something that has been there all your life, or is that something that you develop once you're in the media? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah, we never spoke about it actively at home. My mum's a very religious woman. Uh-huh. My dad's absolutely atheist. My mum still volunteers for the local church, St. Vincent de Paul and all that. I'm only aware of her having done that as much as she has now that I'm older. I didn't know as a kid, and I think she did a lot more of it too once she didn't have to look after
and
us.
And how were you raised with the religion in a family where one's one and one's the other? How is it presented to you?
We were religious. We sort of knew Dad didn't believe, but that was never really presented as an option to mm-hmm. us. We weren't forced against our will, but this is one of the things I think is quite insidious.
Didn't sit you down and go, look, do you want to go to hell with Dad
exactly.
or heaven with Mum?
But the thing that's insidious isn't quite the word. But the one thing that I don't think religion realises about itself a lot of the time is that we just believed because Mum told us to believe.
Right.
Even though we had a father in the house who didn't believe, and we were told if we ever asked, didn't believe, that was not enough to make me ever consider that I couldn't believe.
Interesting.
Now, if you're in an evangelical family, I can understand you suddenly get to 22 and meet people and go, fuck, you don't believe in God. What? You don't go to church? That's weird. Maybe I should think about that. I had a dad who didn't believe right. in God and never came to church or anything except weddings and funerals. Never once did anything like that. Didn't, you know, he might have come along to my first communion, but never went to church. That wasn't enough to make me think. So if you're brought up in that environment, that's how empowering and overwhelming that sort of environment is. If you're brought up with a mum who believes in God, you don't want to disappoint her. So I was brought up like that, and I got a scholarship to a Jesuit high school. So was all into that. But I was an altar boy when I was a kid, and like a gun altar boy. When I'd retired. I'd moved out at the age of 14 out of the altar boy thing, and they brought me back.
Right.
One of the priests had a deaconization or something, which is like tough.
Right.
They brought the Spence out of retirement to ring those bells. Baby, don't you worry.
He's still got one more year left in
exactly,
him. And
exactly.
Then we're retiring his cloak.
Exactly. But it was in sort of my late high school or early university years. I just had a bit of a think about it and I thought, oh, yeah. That's clearly not true. But my little brother is still devoutly religious.
And so someone like you who is so logical about at least the world and, you know, is passionate about science and maths and, you know, the exploration of that, how do you then, when you're raising your children, present how the world works to them. Because essentially that's what all these various methods are trying to answer, this one question of when we're young, we need to know it makes sense.
Yeah.
And so we've come up with stories over the years, like, of how it makes sense. Some of people explain it through religion. Some people explain it through their personal, you know, sort of philosophies or beliefs. Some people explain it through science, but even science, it's like, you know, well, the thing about science is it's constantly changing and they're constantly discovering things they thought were true for 1,000 years aren't true, but now we have better information and this is true. Essentially, all those people are looking to do the same thing, which is explain a bit of life. What's it about? Why are we here? Now, as you get older, I think part of what you realize is we're trying to, you know, find, you know, meaning in something that essentially might not have a meaning.
Yep.
Like, you know, it might only have the meaning that we ascribe to that we give to things. So how do you, when your kid looks at you and says, you know, explain the world to me, what is going to be your philosophy about how you present that to them?
We've made it, on the topic of God, Mel and I have made it clear to our girls that we don't believe in God.
Yep.
And they, Ellie starts to realize that in about second grade when there's scripture at school. So some kids go off to scripture and she doesn't.
Yep.
And we've explained to her, look, later in your life, mate, you have a good long think about it. You might agree there's a God. That's fine. But I, you know, I'm more comfortable with the default position of, look, when you're old enough, you make up whatever decision you want on it. Here's what I can't lie to her. Here's what I believe.
Right.
I haven't told her not to believe in a God. Now,
it kind of makes a bit more sense that way, though, because it's sort of that thing of going, look, if you're an adult and you haven't been indoctrinated, I feel like when you look at the evidence,
it's totally up to you.
I mean, it's totally up to you.
You have a long, hard look at it.
But
I was driving her and probably her best friend to something once. And from the back of the car, without me saying a word, and this is before I had told Ellie my position on stuff, but scripture had just started at school. And so some kids were going to scripture and others weren't. And they instantly asked, what are you doing? That sort of thing. Well, scripture's about God. Oh, really? What's that about? Blah, blah, blah. So the conversation, literally in the back of the car, one of them to the other, do you believe in God? The other one, no, I think it's just a story they make up to sort of, you know, scare people. First one, well, you're kidding. Who made the world then? Well, what do you mean, who made the world? Well, God must have made the world. Why? Well, what was there before the world? Well, there was God. Well, what was there before God? Well, no, there's always been God. That makes just as little sense as who made the world. Well, then do you think we go to heaven when we die or not? Of course we don't go to heaven. That's just a story made up to scare people. Well, then what happens when you die? Well, you just get buried in the ground and work. And literally, in six-year-old language, the same age-old questions that people around the world are blowing each other up for was just wrangled backwards and forwards by these six-year-olds in the back of the car for about 5 minutes. It was just fascinating to listen to.
So then the argument that would be made by people who do believe, they'd be saying, well, without that, in your life, how do you be a good person? What is it that drives you to be a good person? And that brings me again to that idea of that you do some stuff for charity and stuff like that. Where does that come from? You're not doing it because you think if you're a good person, you'll get to go to heaven.
No, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, so where does that come from?
Well, in a selfish way, it feels great to do. And I
think that's fine, by the way. I think people always think like that you're meant to be ashamed of it feeling good to do. I think we should be selling charity more on that point.
Like nothing, but I MC these events, like for Red Kite. We did their Red Kite quizzes this year, and across all the events they raised pretty much on the dot of $1 million. And there's people who work incredibly hard at it all year.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, me being there, but I've MC'd a couple of those, three of them this year, and they went pretty well.
Right.
And I'm a crucial cog in a machine that makes $1 million a year.
Right.
For families who don't have the money to deal with the fact that their kids got cancer. If you can't feel pretty good about yourself after a night like that, then I don't know.
But I think this is what we say to people all the time.
Yeah.
For the $5 it cost you to buy, like, the, even that homeless dude a coffee, it feels much better. If someone came up to you and goes, you can feel pretty good for $5, you'd be like, okay, cool.
Exactly.
Actually, I've got $10. Yeah. Can I have two of them? Yeah. Whatever it is. Oh.
Hang on. Shutter guy, excellent.
Anyway, the shutter guy's here.
My home security consultant's arriving.
I mean, I feel like that's enough anyway because we could keep talking all day. So saying that your shutter guy's here, that seems like a good enough way to cut off the end.
We went longer than Samson.
Right, we did go longer.
I had so much more to tell.
Right, well, we have to cut out that one thing.
Nothing happened in His life did it. That was so
funny. We'll have you back. There'll be more to tell. I thought this went really well. Liked it, I didn't tell anyone because it doesn't have a Facebook page or anything yet. So I have or theme music at this stage.
Philosophy.
If people are enjoying it, you can hit me up on the TOEFOP Facebook page or just download it. If you download it off iTunes, it's available in other places, Libsyn and stuff as well. But if you download it off iTunes, leave a rating because the first episode was number one on the iTunes charts for 3 weeks or something. So,
wow.
And that's just because people are rating it
at home.
And so that's really nice. So, look, you know, if you don't like it, then, well, fucking don't rate it because it's free.
Exactly.
Come on.
Exactly.
You made it this far. All right. Cheers, guys. Thanks, Adam.